Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Tomorrow, San Francisco will become the first major U.S. city to honor and recognize over 200,000 women and girls from 13 Asia-Pacific countries who were forced into sexual slavery by the Japanese military during World War II. They were referred to as comfort women, a euphemism used for sex slaves. They're also called grandmas. Decades later, those grandmas who are still alive are still waiting for justice. A 10-foot-tall Women's Column of Strength Memorial will be unveiled tomorrow at St. Mary's Square in Chinatown at 2 o'clock. The statue depicts three girls from China, Korea, and the Philippines standing on a pedestal holding hands. The late grandma, Hak Soon Kim, stands below them on the ground. She was the first woman who broke the silence by publicly speaking out in 1991. Part of the plaque's inscription reads, "This memorial is dedicated to the memory of these women and to eradicating sexual violence and sex trafficking throughout the world." Comfort woman survivor Grandma Yongsoo Lee from Korea will be at tomorrow's unveiling. And you can find more information about it and also see the memorial at yourcallradio.org. Today's guests have been waiting for this day for many years. Former Judge Julie Tang is known as the architect of San Francisco's domestic violence court. She served on the San Francisco bench for nearly 25 years and spent 8 years as an assistant district attorney. Judge Julie is co-chair of the Comfort Women Justice Coalition, a multi-ethnic, multi-interest human rights coalition formed to support the passage of the Comfort Women Resolution in San Francisco in September 2015. And Julie Tang joins us in studio. Hi, Julie. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning. Thank you so much for inviting me to share this event with you.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. I'm so glad we're doing this show. Mm-hmm. We're also joined by Judith Merkinson, a longtime women's and human rights activist specializing in the relationship between militarism and sexual violence. Judith is the co-founder of Gabriela Network, a U.S.-Philippine women's solidarity organization. She first began working with Comfort Women there in 1993. Judith is the national vice president of the National Lawyers Guild and president of the Comfort Women Justice Coalition. And Judith also joins us in studio. Thank you, Judith, for coming in.
Thank you so much.
And we're joined by Tiffany Shung, director of The Apology, a documentary that follows the personal journeys of three former Comfort Women. After decades of living in silence and shame about their past, they know that time is running out to give a firsthand account of the truth and ensure that this horrific chapter of history is not forgotten. It's an incredible documentary, and you can find it on iTunes and Amazon. And Tiffany Shung joins us from Toronto. Hi, Tiffany. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. And I loved your documentary. Thank you so much for making that. Well, Julie Tang, I want to start off with you. You have dedicated your life to exposing violence against women, and this particular issue is so important to you. You worked to get a resolution passed in September 2015 here in San Francisco. Why is this particular issue so important to you?
The Comfort Women sexual slavery system is the largest sex trafficking system conducted by a government in Japan in modern history, and that happened during Second World War in Asia. However, this history is largely hidden for many, many years from the public until sometime in 1991 when Hak Soon Kim, the first Comfort Woman, broke the silence. And further, the whole issue of sexual slavery is something that touches my heart. And the issue is as important as it is that has been largely forgotten and need to be remedied. Now, America is very Eurocentric. So they are very familiar with what happened in Europe, the killing of the Jews and the Holocaust. But all the atrocities that were committed by Japan during the same time that the Jews were killed and slaughtered in Europe were unheard of in America. Hmm. Oftentimes I go around and tell people what happened, they didn't even know about it. So I feel that it is important to share with the world such an important history and to learn from it so that something like that happened in Asia will never happen again anywhere else in this world.
When did you first learn about the Comfort Women?
I learned about it sometime in the 1990s when Hak Soon Kim spoke up. And I do have a lot of background in history of the Japanese atrocities. I was born and raised in Hong Kong. My parents were from China. And when I was growing up, they told me a lot of things that happened, especially the rape of Nanjing. And in my family, we lost two sisters who died during the war when my parents were running away from home when the Japanese invaded their hometown. And during their flight from home, they were settled in some areas where there was a Unit 731, chemical and biological warfare unit deployed by Japan, stationed there. And during that time, a lot of children died. And my two sisters were among the casualties during that time. And all my life, my parents held this deep sorrow in them about the killing of these two daughters. And that sorrow was pervasive throughout the family. We all know about it. And my grandmother could never mention about them without crying. Mm. So is there something deep in me, you know, that harks to these issues? And when I had the opportunity to educate the public, I took that opportunity. And when I read The Rape of Nanjing by Iris Chang, she talked about the power of one. If people can change the world's attitudes about certain things and hopefully bring peace to the community, what I decided that this is an issue that I absolutely had to join up. And that's why. And in the 1990s, after knowing about comfort women, and now that these women are dying, average age being about 95, mm. It is important to do something for them while they are still alive. And that's why Judge Singh, the other co-chair of this group, and I decided to build a memorial to remember them so that the world will not forget them.
The average age is 95. Do we know about how many comfort women are still alive?
Yes, we do. There are about 33 in Korea, less than 20 in China, and one in Taiwan, and a few in East Timor,
wow.
About 10 to 15 in the Philippines. We know one in Australia, and some even in Europe, but no more than 100 comfort women survivors are still alive. And let's remember them and remember this event while they are still alive. I think the Japanese government would like them all to die off, and then, you know, we go into the sunset and forget about it. But, you know, we won't let them.
And Grandma Yongsu Lee from Korea will be at tomorrow's unveiling. Judith, what about you? Why is this issue so important to you?
Well, for me, I started doing this work in 1993, when I was working with women from Gabriela in the Philippines. And after Hak Soon Kim made her revelations, then people started to investigate what happened in other countries in Asia. And all of a sudden, women came out of the woodwork. They're called the Lolas in the Philippines, and we began to do work around that. And actually, we did a tour of one of the former comfort women, Lola Amanita, in 1993. And I've always been concerned with the issue of women's human rights and the link between militarism and sexual violence and women's human rights. So it was very important for me to discuss this. And when people told me about the effort to build a memorial and asked me to join, I was right there.
Mm. Tiffany Shung, you have an interesting story. You're the director of The Apology. This is an amazing documentary that follows the personal journeys of three former comfort women. You say that you didn't know about this issue, so you didn't learn about it from a book. You learned about it directly from these women.
Yes, exactly. I learned about it back in, 2009, really. I read the Nanjing, the book by Iris Chang earlier, and so when I actually first learned about it, it was firsthand through the testimonies of some of the survivors that spoke to a group of educators in Shanghai. And from that point on, my entire life changed, and it had become a mission to try to document and learn all their stories before it was too late. And I saw the relevance of it being that this is not just a historical issue, this is a current day issue that the grandmothers, survivors are still fighting for, but also many young women that are fighting for it. You know, a lot of young women who are still going through a systematical rape system that is still happening all around the world today. Mm. And just like what we talked about, if you don't recognize the past, the probability of it happening again is already happening. So we do need to rectify this. We do need to acknowledge this and have justice served.
Let's talk about their stories. I'm sure a lot of people have heard of the Comfort Women, but might not know of the history. And actually, before we do that, what do you all think of this term, Comfort Women?
Well, I think it's really,
Judith,
it's really interesting because, you know, what does comfort mean? Right? Comfort is nurturing, you know, taken care of. So it's just ridiculous in a lot of ways that these women, that the notion that men have to have sex in order to go forward in war, and that these are comfort women, women who were raped 40 times a day. Mm. That is certainly not comfortable in any way. And the amazing thing about these women is, which people don't realize, is that when they spoke out, when she began to speak out and break this incredible silence of 50 years, because the irony of the situation is that when women are raped, it's our fault. Mm. You know, I think men know that it's wrong, but then they say they have to do it, so therefore the shame is on the women. So when they spoke out, they actually started, they helped to start a whole, like, real sea change in international thinking and international law. And there was a confluence of many different factors, because it was also at the time of the rapes in the former Yugoslavia. And so those things coming together meant that for the first time in human history, really, we said that raping women, that sexual violence during war, and it was also about the whole issue of sexual violence, was a crime against humanity. And people might not think that's a big deal, but actually it's always been accepted that women are supposed to provide comfort. It's normal, and now we're saying it's not.
Actually, before that term came into vogue, you know, during that time, the women were called in China flower maidens. So the Japanese soldiers, when they went into China, they were looking for flower maidens everywhere. And that's the first term that I heard as a child, because my grandmothers were telling me that they were running into hiding when they heard Japanese soldiers coming, or they put, you know, dirt on their face and make themselves ugly and hide out, and because they were looking for flower maidens. During the beginning of the war, the Japanese military brought with them Japanese comfort women. They were prostitutes from Japan. Many of them were sold into sexual slavery at very young age, like 8 or 9. Mm. And when they come into maturity, then they were, you know, they entered into prostitution. And somebody had a contract on them. And unless somebody come and buy them from that prostitution house, they remain there. And then when they get older and no longer useful, then they work as slaves. But so the men were accustomed to having women at the disposal for the sexual pleasure. So when they came to China, they looked for they looked for women to rape. And then from that point on there was a lot of venereal diseases that they were catching from their own Japanese prostitutes. So they decided they wanted to look for virgins. And that's why the flower maiden name came into being. They wanted Korean virgins, they wanted Chinese virgins, the local girls were virgins. And they were as young as 9, 10, 11 years old. It's all a part of, as Judith said, the misogyny, you know, attitude that men have an entitlement, especially when they go to war. Oh, another myth that the Japanese soldiers had was that if they had sex before they go to war, then the chance to be killed has lessened. Mm. So all this myth perpetrated, and the Japanese military decided to organize a regimented system where it is strictly controlled by the military to allow them have so-called official sex. They were given coupons or rewards when they do good in the battle, so they can go into comfort women stations and visit these young girls who were virgins when they were first brought in. And all these women were there usually for 2-3 months because their fatality rate is so high. The rate was, take a guess, Rose, what do you think is the fatality rate for these women?
Well, in the documentary, one of the women became sterile And that got me thinking about that. It has to be incredibly high.
Mm-hmm. Take a guess. Just give me
65?
One number.
65?
It's 87%.
Wow.
And take a guess, what's the fatality rate for frontline Japanese combat soldiers? What do you think is their fatality rate?
Very low.
Take a guess.
10%.
It's 20%, 27%. Mm. But comparing a Japanese soldier who took the bayonet, go out to fight, to some woman who's lying in the little hut, opening up her legs to be raped 30, 60 times a day, it is a slaughterhouse. And that's why it was documented in Shandong in China. There was a comfort station. There was a Chinese overseer there. You know, he was there to clean up and all that. He said every 2-3 months, there would be a new ration of women coming in because those women that were there, they were killed. And actually, there was a U.S. archives to show that women were considered provisions, just like meat, office supplies, weapons. They were part of the provisions that were ordered. And that's how women were treated. And are we going to allow this history to be buried? No, we cannot. That's why we have the memorial there, to remind the world that these are girls. And these, by the way, the models who set for the memorial, they were in their, like, they're teenagers and maybe 18 years old at most. So they represent the girls that were sex slaves of the World War II.
They called them latrines.
Mm. Tiffany, again, you spent time with three former women, and a number of these women told you that initially they thought they were getting factory jobs.
Yes, some of them had thought that it would be a job. Some of them were kidnapped straight from their homes and just, like, taken right off the street. So there was different variations of how a lot of these women, young girls, were taken. And, you know, over the course of, I guess, now 7 years of knowing these women and getting to know them, it's fascinating to not only see and understand what they had endured, but to understand how they've survived all these years and how they've lived with keeping this a secret within their own families, or trying to continue living a quote-unquote normal life afterwards. Mm. And so to understand that is truly remarkable, which then, I guess, when you see the apology, to really understand the resilience of these women, because it's unfathomable to have to endure what they had endured and to still live on to tell the story is truly remarkable.
What was also remarkable is when you were filming the stories, sometimes these women were telling you what happened to them in the company of their children, and their children were just learning about this for the first time.
It was very surprising to me, specifically in China. There's so many survivors when we started filming and in the villages that we knew were survivors but couldn't actually talk to us or could speak out because their family members were around. And actually, in one incident in a village in China, one of the grandmothers pulled us aside and wanted to talk to us because her kids had left into the city, and she just wanted to tell somebody. It wasn't around being in a documentary or having a story recorded. She just wanted to have someone listen. And really, that's the heart of the story of the apology, is listening. Us, you know, as supporters, as, you know, the next generation, what can we do? And the start is to listen. And from there, to creating a safe space for survivors today, because there are so many survivors, you know, at such a young age, having a difficulty of just telling their own family members is where it all begins. You know, like, how do you expect a country to bring justice to survivors if you and your own family and community can't recognize this issue, can't speak about this? And I do say that, I emphasize on that, because, you know, sexual violence against women is happening at a constant, if I say it's an epidemic, you know, that goes on and keeps growing. And there's just more clever ways right now to get away with it. Human trafficking, you know, is still happening at high rates right in our own backyards, not just something happening, you know, hundreds and thousands of miles away from us.
Right.
You know, it's right in our backyard. And so we have to acknowledge that, you know, how can we, you know, everyday citizens, how can we bring about change to this? You know, and I think it starts with creating a safe space in our own families, in our own households, in our own communities to to listen, to create a space where we can just hear these stories.
Tell us more about what these girls, some at the age of 13, endured. How long were they there, and how did they finally get away?
They couldn't live too long. As I said, 2-3 months is about the average time that they spend in a comfort station.
Wow.
And a majority of them died. They was very malnutrition. They don't even get enough food. Some of them even have to forage their own food. They are not paid well, as the denialists are saying that they are well-paid prostitutes. They were denied medical services. And many of them had venereal diseases. They were not treated. Many of them become pregnant. And those who were pregnant were either killed or have forced to have self-aborted. In fact, the last comfort woman who died just a month ago, she bore a Japanese son, a son from a Japanese military man. And they were actually able to find that man in Japan. They knew who it was. He acknowledged it for some reason. You know, he said, yeah, you know, I think they must have done something to find out. But he acknowledged it, but he never saw his son and never wanted to. The son was shunned by the community because he was Japanese soldier's son, and was taunted and treated badly when he was growing up. I mean, this son, he didn't commit any crime. He's innocent, you know, much like the dreamers, you know what I'm saying?
Mm.
And and then the mother also suffered tremendous taunting and humiliation. She died with a lot of anger, much like those women in Apology. So she was one of the women who actually participated as a complainant, filing a suit against Japan for the atrocities committed and demanding compensation. Unfortunately, every single one of these lawsuits that were filed in the Tokyo High Court got rejected. Japan hid behind a treaty with China that allegedly diplomatically absolved Japan of any remediation or reparation required. But then they have a moral obligation. They also have obligation to the people. Maybe the country to country absolved each other, but the people have not joined in, much like the agreement that was signed, you know, between Korea and Japan in 2015. The victims were not involved in that agreement, but I guess we can talk about that a little bit later.
Judith, is there anything you'd like to add just about what these young women, girls went through and how they got out?
Well, as Julie said, most of them didn't get out. The vast, vast majority died.
So the numbers are over 200,000?
Well, now, actually, there's been recent scholarship, and, you know, the records are beginning to come out. And the Japanese took very good records, and they've been in archives, a lot of them in China. And the Chinese government is now releasing them. And it's thought now there are probably 500,000
Wow.
women, probably 200,000 women in China at least, you know, were sexually enslaved. And that doesn't include the tens of thousands that were just raped. I mean, the Japanese government said they set up these comfort systems because their soldiers were raping so many women in China that they had to control it. So then they just had official raping. And the thing about these comfort stations that's so important to recognize, because people will say, well, doesn't everybody do it? And of course they do, but these were institutionalized and they had a complete system going. And after the war, those institutionalized ways of dealing with sexuality and with women were taken over by the Americans. And then that was taken over during the Korean War. There's still tons of, you know, brothels around the bases in Korea. And then they went to Vietnam. And actually then they led to the system of sex slavery and sex trafficking. So all of these, there's like a progression between what happened then and what happens now. And I really agree with Tiffany. You know, history, James Baldwin said, history is never past. It is always with us. It's present.
But I think I wanted to just make a distinction, and that is Japan is the only government that officially started this comfort women system. Other countries, and like Merck was saying, when they went into Korea or Vietnam, they visit brothels and prostitutions. But America as a government, or any other government that I know of, no government has actually started a system of that that magnitude, the kind of volume of people that they induced, kidnapped, coerced into sexual slavery was just unmatched. And it's a single incident of that nature. And that single incident must be commemorated and remembered.
Julie Tang served on the San Francisco bench for nearly 25 years and spent 8 years as an assistant district attorney. She is co-chair of the Comfort Women Justice Coalition, and she worked on the passage of the resolution in San Francisco in September 2015. Judith Merkinson is National VP of the National Lawyers Guild and president of the Comfort Women Justice Coalition, and Tiffany Shung is director of The Apology, a documentary that follows the personal journeys of three former Comfort women. And you can watch it now at iTunes and Amazon. Tomorrow, San Francisco will become the first major U.S. city to honor and recognize over, well, now we're hearing 500,000 women and girls. This is according to recent scholarship from 13 Asia-Pacific countries who were forced into sexual slavery by the Japanese military during World War II. A 10-foot-tall Women's Column of Strength memorial will be unveiled tomorrow at St. Mary's Square in Chinatown at 2 o'clock. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may leave a comment at the show's website, set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, and you can also tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. There's so much to discuss. We'll talk about the coverage of the deadly earthquake in Mexico, the plight of more than 400,000 Rohingya Muslims fleeing Myanmar, and the ongoing protests in St. Louis over the acquittal of Jason Stockley, a white police officer charged with the shooting and killing of Anthony Lamar Smith, a black driver who also had a one-year-old daughter at the time of his killing. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about history. San Francisco tomorrow will become the first major U.S. city to honor and recognize over 500,000 women and girls from 13 Asia-Pacific countries who were forced into sexual slavery by the Japanese military during World War II. These women are referred to as the Comfort Women. The memorial will take place in St. Mary's Square in Chinatown at 2 o'clock, and Comfort Woman survivor Grandma Yongsoo Lee from Korea will be at the unveiling. About 100 women are still alive, 33 in Korea, less than 20 in China, 1 in Taiwan, 1 in Australia, a few in East Timor, and 10 to 15 in the Philippines. And we're talking about this today with Judge Julie Tang. She served on the San Francisco bench for 25 years. She's co-chair of the Comfort Women Justice Coalition. Judith Merkinson is president of the Comfort Women Justice Coalition. And Tiffany Shung is director of The Apology, an incredible documentary that follows the personal journeys of three former Comfort women. You can watch it online now at iTunes. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We should say that a lot of articles say that there were about 200,000 Comfort women, but today's guests say that according to recent research, there were 500,000. And let's hear from June in Berkeley. Hi, June. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me on. I'm the daughter of a Korean Comfort woman. I wish we could think of a different word for that as well. I have to say it affected her profoundly throughout her life. She was rather dissociated for her entire life before she died about 20 years ago. But I also, at the same time, would like to, I hope we can remove this element of righteous indignation, because after living in South Korea, I also lived in Saigon, and I saw and knew a lot of women and soldiers. There's just a tremendous amount of psychic pain in a war. And, you know, a lot of the women that I knew were, you know, some of them were prostitutes and were forced into it, or it was just inevitable for them. And this kind of sexual slavery that goes on around war grows exponentially and during war. And also Thailand, you can see the effects of the Vietnam War and the sexual slavery that went on in Saigon in Vietnam, I mean in Thailand. Okay. So there's, you know, it's a very complicated issue, and I hope we can look at it in a very complex way as well, and not just, you know, carry the banner forward for all the women who were tortured and maligned, although their cause is also very important.
Can I ask you, June, what do you mean by righteous indignation?
Well, what I mean by that is that, you know, when we look at things, and I know that these very and thoughtful women you have on today are trying to bring this to the fore of our consciousness, but there's this kind of condemnation of all of the men who were involved, and I understand that. I mean, it's a despicable, horrible thing that happened, but at the same time, it prevents us from really understanding the kind of pathology when we just sort of, you know, swipe over them with the brush of they're all bad, they did this terrible thing. Because there's a very complex sort of network of motivations and triggers that go on behind this that have to do with war and our addiction to war, our compunction toward war.
All right. Well, thank you for calling, June. Let's get a response from our guests.
Well, precisely because the issues are so complex, we need to understand it. Whether you want to cloak it with a terminology of righteous indignation or self-awareness or any other comments, I think it's something we have to know. And I think it's something that the young people need to know. And it's only through knowledge, understanding, that we can start unraveling these complexities that June was talking about. And I do appreciate her sharing those comments with us, because when we're going around, you know, talking about this issue, there are so many different reactions from the ones that June shared with us. And then other reactions are like, why even worry about it now? There are other people are doing all these horrible things, and focus on what's going on in the present. Mm. You know, we can ignore anyone for the other. I think it's something that we need to all stand in solidarity and to agree that it is a bad thing, and it's not something so complex that we can give it different kinds of labels and then be done away with it or apologize for it. We need to deal with it. We need to know about it. We need to find a solution for it. And we need to hold the perpetrators accountable, because if people are denying it, that means it's okay to do it. I mean, I see it in my court all the time, in the domestic violence court. Wife beaters, you know, or spouse assault, people who assault their spouses come in and say, well, you know, coming with all kinds of excuses and our relationships are complicated. She provoked me and we have financial issues. I got angry, so I had a few drinks, so I started beating her up, you know. Okay, you have a woman who's half beaten up, but is he sorry about it? No, he's not. And by not being sorry about it, is that means it's okay to do it. And that means it would be continue on something like that. And we need to really understand it before we even try to deal with it.
And to give a voice to these women, Tiffany, in your documentary, The Apology, you interviewed Grandma Gilwan Ok. She's 86, an amazing woman. And we can't play the clip because she was obviously speaking in her native language. But she said, I thought my body was being broken. I cried all the time. I mean, she traveled all over the place to give talks. And she said, for over 70 years, I have not lived like a normal person. In front of an audience, she said, will the wounds go away if you apologize? No, but my heart can heal, and I'm still waiting for that day.
Can you tell us more about
this sentiment and other sentiments you heard from the women you worked with?
Well, specifically with Gilwa No Carmony, traveling, having the privilege to actually travel with her and Mi Hong Yoon over the years, both in Japan and Geneva and U.S. and Canada, really the sentiment, I always ask myself, why do you go through with this? Like, you know, you're sick or you're feeling tired and you're still going, you're still doing this. And really, I feel like the sentiment is, this is for the next generation. As much as it is for me, for my heart to heal, this is also knowing that after I pass, that the younger generation, the women that come after me, will not have to go through the same fight. That knowing that if we do get this justice, things will change for the next generation. And her knowing that brings peace as well. And that's why the fight will continue. Even after the grandmothers have passed away, even though we all hope that this can happen while some of them are still alive. And that's where the energy and motivation comes from. And traveling with them over these years, I can see where that stems from. It is to bring change for all of us.
When Gil Wanok was speaking to young Japanese women, so many young women got up and said they didn't even know much about this. They were crying and said they will do whatever they can to raise awareness and, like you said, to make sure this doesn't happen again.
And you know what? That sentiment is not just in Asia, but all around the world. We've traveled around the world with the apology since our release last year. And every country that I've got to go and attend screenings, whether it's Lithuania or in London or anywhere across the world, the audience reaction, majority of them don't know that this happened, and the sentiment across the board is, you know, they relate to that. They relate to this unspoken part in history or in their family where, you know, they feel like this is really a starting conversation in their own lives. The people are feeling they're able to relate to the grandmothers. And I think that's really important, is not just to look at these women as just survivors and victims, but to really look at them as heroes and pillars for the next generation. And that to me is like, just to look at someone as a victim is almost continuously this cycle of oppression amongst them. We need to also understand what they're doing for us, you know, continuously speaking out. It's not easy what they do every single Wednesday, going out there and demonstrating in the front lines and in front of all these people. You know, it's exhausting. And really, that's what the apology, the film, is doing, is to also shed light on what's happening when the crowd isn't there, when the public eye isn't there, is to actually understand the toll that it takes and why they do what they do for us.
They've been demonstrating every Wednesday in front of the Japanese embassy since 1992, and you were with Gilwan Ok when she attended her 1,000th demonstration.
You know, it's so funny, that day when we were preparing to go with her, the night before, we were talking to her in her bedroom, and we were asking what her thoughts were, if she was excited, if she was nervous, all these feelings, and she said to me, she's like, it's disappointing. I think it's an absolute disgrace that it's taken 1,000th and onward.
And what was incredible, Julie and Judith, when Gilwan Ok is going to her 1,000th protest demonstration, people are yelling at her. They're calling her a prostitute and other things that I don't want to say, but incredibly rude.
Yeah. I mean, the Japanese government has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars and millions of dollars to try to get this issue to go away. And they say outrageous things. And they called Grandma Lee, who's coming here tomorrow, they called her a prostitute in front of the Board of Supervisors. Mm-hmm. And David Campos actually said, shame on you, shame on you. Mm-hmm. And they will do anything to deny history. And we know, living as we do now in the United States, that denialism is extremely dangerous. I mean, people say, why are you talking about this? And because if you deny what happens before, you can't talk about what happens now. You have given permission, you give impunity, and impunity is what makes torture, slavery, etc., go on and on. The fact that the Comfort Women spoke out means that the women in Kurdistan, the Yazidi women who were sexually enslaved. There's all this news coming out. But what's interesting about it is they're talking about it right away. They're dealing with that trauma right away. That wouldn't have happened if we hadn't had these amazing women who were octogenarians speaking out. So there is a continuation between one generation and the next. And, you know, the woman who spoke before, you can't change history. There are things that weren't accepted, that were accepted, actually, like rape, like spousal abuse, like domestic violence, for hundreds of thousands of years. And now, all of a sudden, we're saying those are no longer acceptable. So it's not that we're saying these aren't complicated. We're not that we're saying that it's easy. But what we're saying is we can change the way people look at each other. We can change the way people look at women. And it's happening.
Judith Merkinson is National VP of the National Lawyers Guild and President of the Comfort Women Justice Coalition. Judge Julie Tang is known as the architect of San Francisco's domestic violence court. She served on the San Francisco bench for nearly 25 years, and she is co-chair of the Comfort Women Justice Coalition. Tiffany Shung is director of The Apology, a documentary that follows the personal journeys of three Comfort Women, and you can watch it online on iTunes. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Tomorrow, San Francisco will become the first major U.S. city to honor and recognize 500,000 women and girls who were forced into sexual slavery by the Japanese military during World War II. It's taking place at St. Mary's Square in Chinatown at 2 o'clock. And Comfort Woman survivor Grandma Yongsoo Lee from Korea will be there for the unveiling. And you can find more information about it at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning. I'd like to thank you, Rose, and all the women that are on. I saw the judge, Judge Tang, at the Vets Building, along with one of the Comfort Women, and I wasn't even sure whether I wanted to go to hear something so dark and so potentially depressing. And when I heard the grandma say that she didn't want to leave this for another generation, I said, "What enormous strength of this woman, who her fellow prisoners at one point in time literally bled their fingers so that she could have their blood so that she could survive. I mean, that's how weakened she was by the brutal serial raping." And I think that, you know, if you can find the time to come for an hour or a half an hour, please do. You know, these grandmas have done an enormous amount of work. 1,000 protests once a week is 20 years.
Wow, yeah.
I'd thank you very much, Judge Tang, for all the work you've done.
Thank you. I think I remember you, too. You're the only African-American who showed up in that event. And so I took a picture with you, and I think our picture was printed, actually, in the Chinese newspaper. I want to share that with you. Thank you so much. I just also want to respond to what Merck said earlier about the Japan's denial. I think this whole the history become controversial because of Japan's denial. If Japan had moved forward like Germany did, apologized sincerely, and really hold his own country accountable to these horrific things that they did during the war, we would be here just talking about a memorial and discussing history and really still concerned about this sexual issues that are slavery issues that still exist today. But we would not be expressing the kind of so-called righteous indignation. I think what we should show is righteous outrage about these issues. These are just horrific things that affected hundreds and thousands of women and their families and their children. And unfortunately, many of them didn't have children because of these issues. But it became the genesis, almost like a model for the future future that where sexual slavery continue to exist. And I hope that some of these things we'll learn from, that there will be a glimmer of light. And as someone said, that they are the heroes for our next generation, and we can learn from the comfort women survivors what we should do for society at this point.
To your point about apologizing, a number of media outlets, including the BBC, have reported that the Japanese government has struck a deal with North Korea and had apologized and agreed to pay compensation to the survivors. But there were many letters to the Chronicle. You both have written letters saying that this is a misconception. None of the surviving women were consulted, and they don't recognize this agreement.
That's true. There was an agreement. South Korea,
I'm sorry.
Although some of the comfort women were from North Korea, as what was now considered North Korea. Yes, the foreign ministers of South Korea and Japan met in 2015. There actually is no official document that came out. There was no official treaty. And they said that there was an agreement that was irrevocable, that the issue was closed, and that that was it, and that they agreed to pay into a private fund for the remaining comfort women. There are so many things wrong with this. Number one, they never consulted any of the grandmothers. Number two, it wasn't an official treaty. Number three, they only talked about the relationships between Japan and Korea. They didn't include any of the other countries. And number four, it wasn't a legally binding official apology. And so it's even unclear whether it actually happened exactly. But now the governments of Korea and other countries are saying we have to revisit this. Now, of course, the recent stuff that's happening between North Korea, Japan, Korea, South Korea, the Philippines, is all mushing into this agreement and the whole issue of the comfort women. But what's interesting is if you read even right-wing, like Foreign Affairs and mainstream media, even those people, the so-called experts, are saying that that agreement really wasn't binding and really didn't happen. What's upsetting to us in particular is that there are forces in the Bay Area who are insisting that there was an agreement and who have really stood in the way all along for 2 years and put all these barriers in front of us for this agreement. And we're saying, why?
Mm. We have just a couple minutes left, and you brought in this beautiful photo of the memorial. And as I said in the introduction, the statue depicts three girls from China, Korea, and the Philippines, and they're standing on a pedestal. They're holding hands, and they're looking out. And then the late grandma, Hak Soon Kim, stands below them on the ground, and she has her hands sort of right at her waist. She was the first woman who broke the silence by speaking out in 1991. Can you briefly talk about this beautiful statue and what went on behind the scenes?
Yeah, what happened behind the scenes was that it reflects the diversity and solidarity of the community of women that get together to build this Comfort Women Memorial. And these three women represent victims of the countries where the majority of the comfort women were coerced into sexual slavery. They are actually housed right now on the rooftop of 500 Pine Street, a newly built building that flushed, and this rooftop flushed flush into the St. Mary's Square. And this is a very new park, and it would be open to the public in a very short time. Right now, it's still in private property, but it will be deeded to the city and county of San Francisco. And behind this memorial will be this high rise, you know, that housed hundreds of office buildings. And yesterday, when we were installing them, actually, there were a group of women across from us in the building looking out, putting up signs that says, thank you, you know, and we're waving at them. But it also shows the vulnerability of these girls behind, with all these huge buildings towering over them, like all these forces of evil that were encircling them at one point in time. But look at how they hold their hands together and look out to the world with a defiance and resilience, like, we won't let you forget, and this is what happened to us. We are strong, we will stand together. Now, grandma is looking at them. Grandma is not on a pedestal, as you see. And the reason why she is not in a pedestal, because she was alive, you know, and she is still alive. She is a symbol of all the grandmas that are still alive. They're still looking up to their past and reminding the world not to forget this history, that it bears importance to remember that and to learn from that history.
Yes, like she's looking at her former self and remembering. Remembering all the women that passed before her. Mm. It's really, really beautiful.
So beautiful. Tiffany, we have just a couple minutes left. What do these memorials mean to the grandmas you spent time with, Gilwan, Ok, Adela, and Cao?
Well, I think for Grandma Cao, who I just saw a few weeks ago, I am able to bring photos and captures from the rest of the world to share with her. And I think she's just blown away that the story will be remembered. Right now, I think the most important is just family life and just the day-to-day, everyday thing. And also the importance of knowing that there are people still listening and that they will be memorialized and that there will be a memory of this. And that's really important to someone like Grandma Cao, where, you know, she lives in such a remote village, you know, with a population of 200 people. So to be able to know that, you know, halfway across the world this is happening is tremendous for her. And for Grandma Gil, I mean, she's still on the road. I think she's traveling in a few weeks to the U.S. as well.
So. Amazing.
Yeah, so it does mean a lot to them to know that this will be lived on.
Grandma Gil's quote, once again, when she was speaking in front of an audience, and she's 86, still traveling on a regular basis. For over 70 years, I have not lived like a normal person. Will the wounds go away if you apologize? No, but my heart can heal, and I'm waiting for that day.
Yeah, we try to get grandmas from China and the Philippines, but the grandma in China was just too old and too frail. I met one when I was in China last year, and she was so old, so tiny, and I think she has passed on since we saw her. And then the Filipino grandmas couldn't come because of the visa issues, because of the immigration ban, you know.
Wow.
So you know how that affects, you know, even what we're doing here.
You know what's interesting is there's been all this controversy about statues, but here we have an amazing statue to these incredible women. Mm. And I really hope that everybody can come. If you can't come tomorrow, then come some other time when this statue is going to be there for eons and eons. It will outlive all of us. And I also like to say to you that if you can't come for the unveiling, come to our reception, which is going to be at the Hilton Hotel in Chinatown, and it starts at 4:30.
And tomorrow, the Women's Column of Strength Memorial will be unveiled at St. Mary's Square in Chinatown at 2 o'clock here in San Francisco. Judith Merkinson is president of the Comfort Women Justice Coalition. Judge Julie Tang served on the San Francisco bench for nearly 25 years, and she's co-chair of the Comfort Women Justice Coalition. Tiffany Shung is director of The Apology, a documentary that follows the journey of three former Comfort women. You can watch it online at iTunes. Tiffany, Judith, and Judge Julie, thank you all for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to Sanaa Saleem for producing today's show. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thank you for joining us. It's Your Call.